I stopped at slide 10, which is a little cartoon that illustrates a spinal reflex. A reflex is a functional unit of the nervous system, meaning that it's as simple a process as you can get that does all of the major functions of the nervous system, which is to receive input, process that input, in other words, integrate it, and cause an output. And so the simplest situation anatomically is for you to have just two neurons, but you also have to have a receptor. The first thing you have to have in terms of the flow of information is some sort of receptor. What's a receptor? It can be as simple as the ending of a sensory neuron itself, a free nerve ending, in other words, or it could be a specialized cell. But it's some structure that is able to respond to a stimulus. Remember that a stimulus is some event or condition that can cause a change in membrane potential at a receptor. All right, so that's you have to have a way to know that something's going on at the surface of the body or inside the body. That's what stimuli do. And that can be actually part of the sensory neuron, but in any case, you need some sort of receptor. Of course, you need to have a way for that information to travel to the central nervous system. So an absolute requirement is a sensory neuron. That gets you to the spinal cord or the brainstem, depending on where the information's traveling from. But in this case, it's the spinal cord, just because this is a spinal reflex. That sensory neuron ends in the central nervous system, and in the very simplest case, it could simply synapse with a motor neuron that starts out in the spinal cord and then goes to an effector. That's not what is shown here. There is this red interneuron. Interneurons are shortish neurons that occur entirely within the central nervous system. And these wirings for reflexes, which are called reflex arcs, can include interneurons and often do. But an interneuron is not an absolute requirement. You have to have a receptor, you have to have a sensory neuron, and then you have to have a motor neuron. But there can be a direct connection between the sensory neuron and the motor neuron. All right? Motor neuron, absolutely necessary. And, of course, the motor neuron travels from is connected at the beginning at the central nervous system, spinal cord in this case, and extends all the way to the effector organ. And an effector organ, as far as the nervous system is concerned, is a muscle or a gland. Okay? And it's an effector organ because the motor neuron causes that structure or cell to effect some change. And what is that change? Well, it's whatever is necessary to reduce the error that the original stimulus represents. Okay? In other words, reflexes work homeostatically via negative feedback. Well, you have this dashed line indicating, well, first of all, notice this dashed line is a collateral axon. It's branching off of the sensory neuron axon. And so, like any collateral, it's going to fire an action potential whenever that sensory neuron is fired. Because, as I said before, a neuron can't decide that an action potential is going to go down just this branch and not another. And where this branch goes, as you see, is up to the brain. So a reflex can operate, a spinal reflex can operate without the brain involved. But the brain gets to learn that it's happening. And therefore the brain can give you the awareness that that reflex is happening. And also the brain can allow you to suppress the reflex if the stimulus continues. That's what that ascending information, that ascending sensory information going to the brain can give you. So that's the functional unit of the nervous system, reflexes. But a lot of things happen reflexively, but of course it can be a lot more complicated than that because the wiring can get a lot more complicated than that, especially in the brain. So let's do a very quick anatomical survey of the brain. This is slide 11. I mentioned the last time that there are four primary divisions of the brain. One of them is the cerebrum, which is the largest part, which is the wrinkled surface, and that word means brain. And you see from the coloring, the cerebrum, the surface of it, which is the cerebral cortex, is itself subdivided into what are called lobes. Actually, the overall cerebrum is first divided into hemispheres. There's a right and a left half. Those are hemispheres. And each hemisphere is then divided into lobes, which are named for the bones of the cranium that roughly correspond to their position. So you have frontal lobe, parietal lobe, occipital lobe, temporal lobe, named after those four bones that occur on either side of in the cranium. I was just going to say something. Well, oh, yeah, I remember. The reason that this is called the cerebral cortex is because of the word cortex, remember, means a superficial part of an organ, whereas a deeper part is called a medulla. Medulla means marrow. So the brain isn't the only place where you have a cortex and a medulla. You have it in, for instance, the kidney, the renal cortex, renal medulla, adrenal cortex, adrenal medulla. Cortex and medulla are words that come in pairs and mean superficial and deep, respectively. The second major division of the brain, well, I guess second doesn't make any sense. They're not ordered. But the second one I'm going to talk about is the brainstem, shown in D here. And the brainstem itself then is further subdivided into the midbrain, which is the superior-most part of the brainstem. It's at the top. The pons, which is a bulbous anterior portion, shown in grayish blue here. And the medulla oblongata, which is the inferior-most part. The medulla oblongata is the most inferior part of the whole brain, because if you go down any farther, you're officially in the spinal cord. In other words, the medulla oblongata directly connects to the spinal cord. But this whole brainstem, midbrain, pons, and medulla oblongata, you see, really serves as the connection point between the rest of the brain and the spinal cord. So a lot of important information travels through the brainstem in both directions. Information that's ascending through the spinal cord and is destined to other parts of the brain, like the cerebrum, or information that starts out in the cerebrum, for instance, and has to descend through the spinal cord, that's going to go through the brainstem as well. The diencephalon is another major, the third of four primary divisions. And the diencephalon sits right on top of the midbrain. Diencephalon, well, remember, encephalon means brain. Di means through or between. So it's the diencephalon gets its name from the fact that it's basically the deepest part of the brain. It's like the brain within is kind of what diencephalon means. And the diencephalon is made up of the thalamus, which is labeled right there at the top, and some structures that get their name because of the proximity of the thalamus, including the hypothalamus, which means below the thalamus. Thalamus itself, by the way, means inner chamber or bedroom, which is usually an inner chamber because of its deepness in the brain. So hypothalamus and then epithalamus and subthalamus are included in there as well, named for their proximity to the thalamus. All of those things that have the word thalamus in them are part of the diencephalon. And then the only thing that I haven't mentioned, the fourth primary division, is the cerebellum, which you see a little bit inferior to the cerebrum and posterior to the brainstem. You really see this, the cerebellum just opposite of the pons. The pons is part of the brainstem. If you look posteriorly, you get the cerebellum. And cerebellum means little brain. Of course, all this stuff is part of the brain. But cerebellum is arranged very much like the cerebrum. It has folds in its surface, just like the cerebrum does, and it occurs in two hemispheres, just like the cerebrum does. Now, slide 12 gives you a very basic, cursory listing of the functions of the brain. Of course, there's a hell of a lot we still don't know about the brain, like most things. But even what we do know, you could take several courses on. That's not what we're going to be doing here. But let's quickly look at this. The cerebral cortex, important for sensory information and motor information. It also includes a lot of what are called association areas that send information from one place of the cerebrum to another place in the cerebrum through what are called association fibers. It's important for perception. Now, perception is your awareness of things. And I'm going to talk more about the difference between sensory information and sensation when we start this next chapter. But things that you're not aware of are plentiful. There's a lot going on in your brain that you aren't aware of that occurs mostly in other parts of the brain. But the stuff that you are aware of is occurring in the cerebral cortex. It's also important for moving your body around, skeletal muscle movement, which is a voluntary act. That starts out, your intentions to do things start out in the cerebrum. Then those signals are traveled to other parts of the brain and eventually out of the spinal cord. But the cerebrum is certainly important in that. So a lot of information about movement, as you see. The basal ganglia, I'm disappointed that this book calls these things the basal ganglia still, because it's really a misnomer. The only reason that the term basal ganglia is still used is because there's still people who are alive who learned it that way, and they want to keep using the words they learned. But the basal ganglia really should not be called that, because there are no ganglia in the central nervous system, right? A ganglion is a group of cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system. Well, the brain is part of the central nervous system, so the better word for this is basal nuclei, which you'll see in most books, modern books at least. And they are important for various aspects of movement. We'll look at a picture of them a little bit later, probably. There's also the limbic system, which is part of the cerebrum. The limbic system is kind of deep within the cerebrum and includes a few parts that we'll look at just briefly. The amygdala and the hippocampus make up that's also involved in memory. The amygdala, though, that emotion part, as part of the limbic system, it's not just emotion. It's really the very basic emotions, very strong emotions like fear, raw emotions. All right, the diencephalon, like I said, it includes things related to the thalamus, including the thalamus and including things that are nearby the thalamus, so hypothalamus, but also the pituitary, which, what's a better word for pituitary? The hypophysis. And the pineal gland, which I've mentioned both of those, and the hypothalamus briefly in the previous chapter. The thalamus, it should make sense to you that the thalamus, which lies right on top of the brainstem, is a major relay station, just by virtue of where it is. Information comes up through the brainstem and is sent to other parts of the brain. It's sent to other parts of the brain by going through the thalamus. And so almost all sensory information, the exception is olfactory information about smell, all the rest of the sensory information goes through the thalamus. And so does a lot of information that's descending, information about movement goes through the thalamus as well. So very major relay station. The hypothalamus, I'll have more to say about than I've already said, because I have a table to look at that. And the hypophysis, we've already discussed, secretes various hormones in response to signals from the brain, whether it's the neurohypophysis or the adenohypophysis. It's still hormones that are released. And we talked about those previously. Pineal gland, melatonin secretion, I already talked about that as well. The cerebellum, the little brain, actually contains most of the neurons of the brain, even though it's far smaller than the cerebrum. They're really packed in there. And the cerebellum has various functions, but it's really important for coordination of movements, skeletal muscle movements. It's really important in learned movements, things that you do over and over and really refine. So-called muscle memory, the cerebellum is really involved in that. And then the brain stem, remember, includes the midbrain, pons, medulla oblongata. The midbrain is important for not only eye movement, as is listed here, but also some visual reflexes and some auditory reflexes. The pons, another relay station, but it's particularly a relay station between the cerebrum and cerebellum, which have to communicate. And another thing that's important about the brainstem as a whole is that it's a connection point for what are called the cranial nerves. Cranial nerves are nerves, and therefore they're part of the peripheral nervous system. But what makes them cranial nerves versus spinal nerves is that they connect to the brain instead of connecting to the spinal cord. Well, that connection point is at various places in the overall brainstem. And the brainstem houses a lot of integrating centers, nuclei, that are important for keeping things going well in the background for some really important stuff like breathing, pH, blood pressure, things like that. The set points for those things are housed in various centers. So there's a breathing center, for instance. There's a cardiovascular center and so on. And a lot of those occur in the medulla oblongata. The breathing thing, as you see, is in the pons, but the medulla oblongata, which is right next to the spinal cord, is very important for processing a bunch of this automatically controlled, behind the scenes, unconscious control of stuff. Now, the reticular formation is not a structure that you can point to and say, this is the reticular formation. Reticular means occurring as a network, basically. A reticule is a net or web-shaped object. And so it refers to diffuse branching. And the reticular formation is just that. It's a collection of neurons within the brainstem that are not arranged into a shape you can point to, but that are related functionally and are involved, as you see, in arousal, sleep, pain modulation, other kind of behind-the-scenes things that you don't have to remember to do on your own. All right, now slide 13 gives you another view of stuff we've already talked about, really. This is a close-up view of the diencephalon, including the thalamus itself. The thalamus is kind of shaped like a yo-yo, two halves that are connected in the center by a little stalk. And this is a median view, so it's been cut. And that's why you see the little circle in the thalamus. That's the axle of the yo-yo that holds the two halves together. But what's important here, really, is to show you the relationship between the hypothalamus and the hypophysis. The hypophysis hangs below the hypothalamus, and remember, is part gland and part extension of the brain. The adenohypophysis, which is the other word for the anterior pituitary, is the truly glandular part of the hypophysis. And so it's made up of a collection of just endocrine cells, not neurons. Those endocrine cells, they'll respond to releasing hormones that are produced by neurons in the hypothalamus and travel down the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system and reach their targets in the adenohypophysis, which those cells then release their own hormones. The neurohypophysis is actually an extension of the brain, which is why it's shown in basically the same color as the hypothalamus there. So the neurons, the axons that make up the neurohypophysis or posterior pituitary, have their cell bodies up in the hypothalamus, and then the axons extend down the infundibulum, the stalk that connects the hypothalamus to the hypophysis. So I've already talked about a little bit of what the hypothalamus does, but it's not just important for its endocrine functions. This table on slide 14 shows you some other stuff that it does. Activates the sympathetic nervous system. The sympathetic nervous system is a branch of the autonomic nervous system, which itself, remember, is a branch of the motor division or efferent division of the peripheral nervous system. So it does that by, as you see, controlling catecholamine release from adrenal medulla. The adrenal medulla is really a collection of cells that are developed from the same sort of things that neurons develop from. So the adrenal medulla you can consider as part of the sympathetic division as well, even though they're not technically neurons. So that's important in fight or flight responses. The adrenal medulla releases epinephrine and norepinephrine, or as they're called in Britain, adrenaline and noradrenaline, which are important in fight or flight responses. Another important hypothalamic function is thermoregulation, maintenance of body temperature. Does this by knowing by housing the set point for body temperature and therefore being able to integrate an error, knowing whether the body is too hot or too cold, in other words. And there's various responses to either being too hot or too cold. Shivering, of course, is a response for when you were too cold. Shivering is just uncoordinated skeletal muscular activity that instead of being coordinated in order to cause a major movement of a limb, it's uncoordinated. These fibers are just contracting and kind of working against each other so that you don't you're not bending your limbs really. What you're doing is just generating heat by friction. So you're basically just wasting the energy in a sense in order to produce heat, but it's heat that you want, so it's not really a waste. Sweating operates via evaporative cooling. It takes a lot of energy to transform liquid water, which is what sweat mostly is, into water vapor because of the high latent heat of vaporization of water. Well, anyway, where does that heat come from? Your body. So as you sweat, you are losing heat from your body. The same way water in an evaporative cooler in your house loses water, loses heat as it gives up gas as it evaporates. Control of body osmolarity. Osmolarity refers to the overall solute concentration of the various body compartment fluids. Your fluids, remember, including your intracellular fluid and the two extracellular fluid compartments, plasma and interstitial fluid, those are all aqueous solutions. And therefore, they all have various kinds of solutes in them, mostly ions, and ion concentrations make a big deal, are a big deal to maintain those at the proper level, mainly because of what I've already been telling you about how action potentials and graded potentials work. Those are all based on ions, right? If you disrupt that balance, you're going to disrupt a lot of things, including the proper functioning of the nervous system, and for that matter, the muscular system, because they both operate via action potentials. Reproductive functions is a subset of the hypothalamic functions having to do with the endocrine system, and that's because the hypothalamus releases gonadotropin-releasing hormone, as we talked about, and then that gonadotropin-releasing hormone causes release of the actual gonadotropins from the adenohypophysis, luteinizing hormone, follicle-stimulating hormone, which are reproductive hormones. But it also, the hypothalamus also sends signals down to the neurohypophysis, which is really an extension of the hypothalamus after all, and from those axon terminals releases the two neurohormones that are released from the neurohypophysis, which are oxytocin and antidiuretic hormone. Well, the ADH, antidiuretic hormone, has to do with body osmolarity, but the oxytocin is a reproductive hormone. Oxytocin causes the positive feedback mechanism that leads to parturition, childbirth, and it also causes expulsion of milk from the mammary or mammary glands. Prolactin causes milk production in the breasts, but oxytocin, a different hormone, causes it to be ejected from the nipple upon suckling, which is a nervous reflex. There's also what is called the satiety center and the feeding center in the hypothalamus. Satiety is the condition of being satiated or satisfied. So you don't continue to eat forever because once your stomach stretches, for instance, that's a good cue that you've eaten enough, and that stretching sends impulses to your hypothalamus, to the satiety center, that sends other signals to the cerebrum that makes you have the feeling of being full. You don't want to eat any more food because you're satiated. On the other hand, if you haven't eaten for a while, you're going to feel hunger because the hypothalamus is involved as far as the feeding center is concerned. And it interacts with this limbic system, this raw emotion part of the brain. It also influences cardiovascular control because the hypothalamus is hearing about information that's traveling through the brainstem, through the medulla oblongata, about what's happening with the heart and arteries. In other words, it knows how fast the heart is pumping, how forcefully it's pumping, and how much blood pressure there is, because it senses how much stretch there is in the major arteries. The more blood pressure there is, the more the arteries are stretched. So just like the stomach stretching says it's full, the major arteries stretching a lot give an indication to the brain that the blood pressure might be higher than the set point. And negative feedback can take care of that. And then finally, these trophic hormones that we already talked about are the releasing and inhibiting hormones that travel down the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract and cause release of other hormones from the adenohypophysis. So that itself is a really important function of the hypothalamus in the sense that it has all kinds of effects, because the ultimate effects of those hormones is shown throughout the body. But all these other things are pretty important as well. Hypothalamus, even though it's a pretty small part of the brain, has a really important job, set of jobs. Slide 15 cuts the brain in a more or less coronal plane, so that you're looking at it from the front, and these red structures that are indicated are the basal nuclei, which this book calls the basal ganglia. This is just to give you a picture of how this looks. When you look at the overall, before it's cut though, the overall picture in the upper left, hopefully you can realize from the way this is drawn that that is an internal structure that's not on the surface. But the basal nuclei have kind of that weird shape. And like I said, they're really important in movements. When you look at the cut image, you can see the connection point between the two lateral hemispheres of the cerebrum. The two hemispheres are distinct. They have a deep groove between them, but they are connected to each other. And they're connected to each other by fibers that are said to cross over, meaning extend from left to right or from right to left. That crossing over is called decussation. And fibers that decussate or cross over from one side of the brain to the other are said to be commissural fibers. And a structure that includes commissural fibers is a commissure. There's several commissures in the central nervous system, both in the spinal cord and the brain. The main commissure of the cerebrum is the corpus callosum, which is labeled up here. And you can see that that includes a band of neurons, many millions of neurons, that extend from one side to the other. They decussate. Slide 16 gives you a view of the limbic system, the hippocampus and the amygdala, which are labeled there, are these parts that are collectively called the limbic system. Memory and emotion are the important things here. Hippocampus, the word hippocampus means seahorse, which is what it's kind of shaped like, I guess. Amygdala means almond. All right, slide 17, another one of these flowchart type things. On the left, you have a simple neural reflex, as simple as it can get. You have some sort of sensory input about something that's happening in the world or in your body, and that information is integrated once it reaches the central nervous system, either brain or spinal cord, and it forms some sort of simple output, an action potential in a motor neuron, namely, and that release of neurotransmitter from that motor neuron causes some effector organ to have a response that will tend to undo whatever the stimulus is in many cases. Well, that's basically how the spinal reflexes work. The spinal cord does some integration, but it doesn't do much high, it doesn't do high-level processing. It doesn't do perception, for instance. It doesn't give you any awareness. When the brain's involved, though, things are a little bit more complicated, and that's what's shown in B. It's still basically the same flow chart, except you have the behavioral state system and the cognitive system added here. The behavioral state system really just refers to parts of the brain that are involved in your behavioral state. I don't know how better to say it. Cognition involves things that you are basically the boss of. That's why it's listed as voluntary. So what's happening in your life, what you intend to do, those things can affect how what would otherwise be a normal, simple reflex occur. And that's why stress in your life, for instance, can actually cause, it's not just that you're worried about something if you're stressed, that actually can cause behind the scenes functions in your body to be affected because it interferes with the flow of information in the form of action potentials because of all the wiring is interconnected. On slide 18, I want to introduce two important parts of the cerebral cortex that occur more or less along the middle sides. And first, let me just say that the surface of the cerebral cortex has these folds in it, which are like hills and valleys. The valleys are the little cracks. The hills are the smooth parts. Those hills are called gyri, the singular of which is gyrus. And the cracks, or the valleys, are called sulci, the singular of which is sulcus. And you see that there's sulci all over the surface, but there is one particular sulcus that gets its own special name because it's, first of all, it's not as meandering as the other ones is. It kind of makes a straight shot down the middle of the side. And it's the sulcus that occurs between the red and the blue section right there. And that's called the central sulcus. And the central sulcus is an important landmark because it separates roughly the front of the cerebral cortex from the back of it. And the reason that's important is because the front of the cerebral cortex is mostly concerned with motor activity, motor information, I guess I should say, whereas the back part is more concerned with sensory information. And so immediately on either side of that central sulcus, you have a gyrus. The gyrus right in front of the central sulcus is called the precentral gyrus, because it's right in front of the central sulcus. That's the darkest red part there. And that's the anatomical name of that gyrus, but functionally, what is housed there are neurons that make up what are called the primary somatic motor cortex. Or, as you see, just primary motor cortex in some books. Immediately behind the central sulcus is the gyrus that's called the postcentral gyrus. And it houses a bunch of neurons that collectively form what are called the primary somatic sensory cortex, not motor. So you see this division from front to back between motor information and sensory division. Sensory information comes in from all places, basically, from various places in the head where the special sense organs are located. The special sense organs are ears, eyes, nose, and tongue. and also from general senses, which are spread out throughout the rest of the body. And that sensory information goes to different places that are named for what kind of sensory information they take care of. So there is a gustatory cortex, if you look deeper into the surface. Gustatory cortex for taste, because taste is gustation. There's an olfactory cortex for smell, which is olfaction. Those occur more or less toward the front. But on the back here, in the very back, you have the visual cortex at the occipital lobe. Even though information is coming into your eyes in the front, that sensory information is sent to the occipital lobe. You have an auditory cortex right there in the temporal lobes, close to where the ears are, and so on. So sensory information is dealt with in the back part of the cerebral cortex. Motor information is dealt with in the front. And skeletal motor information, meaning the action potentials that cause your skeletal muscles to move, that's up to you. Your skeletal muscles are voluntarily controlled. So you decide to move your fingers to take notes. Right? It's not an autonomic function. Well, that intention to bend your knee or whatever action you're trying to do, starts out in neurons that are part of the prefrontal cortex, or as it's labeled here, the prefrontal association area. All right, so that's where you come up with the idea to move a part of your body. That information then is sent to the area of the cortex just behind it, which is called the premotor cortex, which is in a slightly drabber red. And it's the premotor cortex that takes that information about your intentions and figures out just which of your muscles need to be contracted and in what order for that intended action to actually take place. And this happens very quickly, obviously. So it's pretty amazing processing. And then the premotor cortex basically figures out how to do it. And then it sends information to neurons that are in the primary motor cortex, which is on the precentral gyrus. And it basically activates the appropriate neurons of that primary motor cortex that will send information down the spinal cord, out spinal nerves, and to the correct muscles for you to actually bend your limb that way, if that's what your intention is. Okay, so it's a series of upstream neurons that have to be activated, going from prefrontal cortex to premotor cortex to primary motor cortex. And then starting at the primary motor cortex, once it's already determined what the information stream is going to be, you have what are called descending pathways that move from the cerebrum down through the spinal cord, out through spinal nerves to the appropriate effector organs. The effector organs in that case, of course, would be skeletal muscles. Well, this view of the cerebrum in slide 19 gives you another good view of the corpus callosum, which is the band of commissural fibers that decussate from one side to the other. But the main point of this slide is to show you that while the two cerebral hemispheres are symmetrical with respect to size and shape, they're not perfectly symmetrical with respect to function. In other words, the left side of the brain doesn't do just a mirror image of whatever the right side does. What you see here is that the left hemisphere is more important for writing, for instance, which is why you have the hand with the pencil there. Whereas the left I mean, whereas the right brain is more important for analysis by touch. Now, this is in most people. It can be reversed, but this is the situation for most people. But anyway, these differences that you see here is why people talk about left brain, right brain things. You know, mathematical ability versus spatial ability versus language ability. Those things are not doled out evenly between the sides. But a pretty neat trick is that if there's damage to one side, then the other side can basically take up the slack given time. In other words, you can relearn how to do things on the other side of the brain that you've already been doing for years on the original side. But this also shows you that there's obviously communication between the two sides through the corpus callosum, and that allows for a lot of things, like mixture of information coming from the two eyes, allowing you to have stereo-optic vision, which gives you depth perception. Notice that the two optic nerves that are coming from those two eyeballs themselves actually decussate, or cross over at what is called the optic chiasm. And information is sent to either side of the brain. Now, this is a pretty cool slide. Slide 20 shows you snapshots of a real-time imaging of electrical activity in the brain. And on the left side of the brain, in most people, that's where language information is processed to a much greater degree. And there are two important areas called Wernicke's area and Broca's area, which those are the eponymous words, of course, named after people. But the better word for the better names for them is Wernicke's area is also known as the sensory speech area. Broca's area is better known as the motor speech area. Well, based on what I told you about front versus back, it should make sense that the Wernicke's area, which is the sensory speech area, is located in the back part of the left cortex, left hemisphere, I mean, and Broca's area toward the front, because that's the motor speech area. What's the difference between sensory speech and motor speech? Well, when you think about language, it's not just a simple thing. Language is probably the most amazing thing we do. But, for instance, when you sensory speech or sensory language has to do with your interpretation of what these words mean, right? When you read a book, a lot of stuff's going on. At first, you're seeing these symbols, which, before you learn to read, are meaningless, of course. But sensory speech involves turning these abstract images first into letters that you know what individual letters mean. But then you also have to process certain collections of letters into words, different kinds of words into ideas, right? So when you're reading, you have to interpret those symbols. And that's going to involve Wernicke's area, the sensory speech area. So when you're seeing words, that's happening at the visual cortex in the back, because that's where all visual information goes. And then that visual cortex sends information to Wernicke's area, which is where the hot spot is on hearing words. Because whether you're hearing it or you're seeing it, they both sends it to Wernicke's area. You have to interpret those words. Anyway, what I'm saying is Wernicke's area is located right about where the hot spot on hearing words is. And then if you imagine sitting by yourself reading, you might sometimes catch yourself mouthing the words as you read them, even though you're not talking. So you're basically sending information to another part of your brain to figure out how to pronounce those if you were to read it out loud. And that's motor speech. So that information is sent to the motor speech area, Broca's area, which is located where generating words hotspot is. And then that motor speech area figures out all the complex ways of moving your tongue and other and your throat and all the things that are involved in producing this, the words. And then those signals are sent to the appropriate place in the motor cortex to make those muscles move correctly. Very complex set of events that happens in real time quickly. Slide 21, I really wasn't going to include this. I'm not going to mention anything about all these, the directionality of these arrows. The only reason I included this slide is just to introduce the names of these four important neurotransmitters that are used quite a bit in the central nervous system. These are norepinephrine, which is also used in the peripheral nervous system, dopamine, serotonin, and acetylcholine. Acetylcholine and norepinephrine are both used in the peripheral nervous system as well. But likely you've heard these anyway. These are just individual neurotransmitters. For this next slide, slide 22, it's really hard to describe emotions and what they actually are, but they are brain activity somehow, and they are created partially as a result of sensory stimuli, as you see here. This flowchart shows kind of a normal pathway that we've talked about before, sensory stimuli impinging on the cerebral cortex. It's the cerebral cortex where perception occurs. Your awareness of things doesn't occur until that information reaches the cerebral cortex. So, you know, you'll retract your hand away from a hot stove very quickly, because all it takes is for that information to get to the spinal cord. You're going to be moving your hand away before you're aware of it even, before you even feel it, because that reflex works faster than it takes to send that information up to the cerebrum and process it into the sensation of feeling the heat. But you do feel it, of course, eventually. So these perceptions, these awareness of things, are involved in this feedback that creates awareness of emotions, and that involves the limbic system. And so emotions are kind of complex, weird things to describe, but they also are, they also include a lot of mnemonic information, which are things that have to do with memory, which is why you have such strong emotional reactions to certain smells, for instance. You know, you can smell when it's a certain time of year. It brings back memories of things that you've done that time of year, for instance. It's really a complex set of feedback loops that's occurring. But the limbic system gets involved to create these emotions, and your emotions actually develop because of your experience. And then the last part of this chapter is about memory itself, which is a pretty, we could spend a long time on just memory. But what I want you to know from this slide 23 is that there is short-term memory and long-term memory. You probably already know this. Short-term memory is adapted to just allow you to do things moment to moment. You know, it would suck if you didn't remember something 1 second ago, because you need more than just one bit of information in order to interact properly with the world. You need to coordinate things based on a bunch of things that are happening moment to moment. And short-term memory is important for that. And it's not necessarily important for you to remember all of those little bits of information forever. Why fill up your brain with stuff that you only need to know at the moment? So there's specific places in the brain that operate just for short-term memory. But those short-term memory centers are hooked up to long-term memory centers, which are adapted to keeping that information in there for the long haul. Now that can be through repetition, for instance, which is why the more you study, the more you're able to recall that information at the time of a test. So just doing the same thing over and over can lead to long-term memory, but so can just conscious effort into putting it into long-term memory originally. I mean, you can literally try, you know, when you meet someone, a lot of people do this. They are introduced to someone, they hear the name, it's in short-term memory, then they 5 minutes later they won't be able to remember what their name is. But if you make a conscious effort to put that name into long-term memory, then you'll be able to recall it. It's not until it gets into long-term memory, though, that it's going to be able to be recalled, because if it's not put into long-term memory, it's going to be lost. Slide 24, I actually had this out of place. This should have been right before we looked at that diagram of the firing hotspots. But it shows you where Wernicke's area and Broca's area are. Wernicke's area toward the back, because it's the sensory speech area and sensory information is dealt with in the back of the cerebrum. Broca's area is motor speech area. Okay, so you see words, that fires the visual cortex, information is sent to Wernicke's area about what those words mean. Broca's area is involved in figuring out how to actually pronounce those words, and then that plan of action is sent to the motor cortex, because the motor cortex is the beginning of descending pathways that actually connect to the appropriate muscles to do that. And similarly for hearing, except that the original part is the auditory cortex instead of the visual cortex. The cranial nerves are listed here just in case you want to know their names, but I don't want you to memorize the cranial nerves for this class. And this long-term memory stuff on slide 26, I guess I just want you to know the difference between implicit and explicit memory, or as they're otherwise called, reflexive memory and declarative memory. Reflexive meaning of a reflex occurring by reflex, or implicit meaning implied. Those names are given because, as you see here, the recall is automatic. You don't have to try to remember certain things. In fact, you'll find yourself doing things that you didn't even realize you were doing. This happens a lot while driving, for instance. You can be thinking of something while you're driving, and it'll seem like 5 minutes you've been thinking about a problem or something, and you say, well, how in the hell was I driving this whole time? But, I mean, that can happen. You don't have to. Memory doesn't happen just consciously. It's working in the background as well. On the other hand, there are definitely some things that you need to try, give a concerted effort to recall from long-term memory. Things like answers to test questions. Okay? So that's that chapter. Now, any questions before I just break the ice on this next chapter, this sensory information chapter? Everyone ready for Tuesday's test? Just wanted to see whether there was a response. It's not on Tuesday.
What's the difference between
norepinephrine and epinephrine are really related, obviously, chemically. I can't remember what makes the difference as far as the chemical structure is concerned. But they often work, both, either one of them will activate an adrenergic receptor. Adrenergic receptors are receptors that are able to bind epinephrine or norepinephrine. So they're agonists. They both have enough of the correct shape. I just don't know what, as far as drawing the chemical structure is concerned, I can't remember what their differences are. Anything else? All right. When is the actual test? It is a Tuesday, though. Okay. Yeah.
It's a primary versus a secondary nitrogen.
That's all it is? So it's exactly the same number of N types of atoms. It's just one placement difference. There's your answer. Oops. So what are we doing here? 10 is the next one, right? Okay. Chapter 11 is about sensory information and the sense organs. And I want to start with this table on slide 1 because I want to right away make a distinction between sensory information and sensation. Sensory information is the bigger group of things. Sensory information just refers to any afferent information. Information coming in to the central nervous system about something that is happening at a receptor. Stimuli need to make themselves known to the central nervous system. They do that by sending sensory information or afferent information. But that doesn't mean you are aware of all that stuff. There's a lot of stuff that the brain is keeping track of that's happening at your body surface or inside your body that you don't know about. Like, you don't know what your body temperature is right now. You don't know what your blood pressure is or your pH. But that your brain does because of sensory information. So it can be conscious or unconscious. If it is conscious, or if it's turned into something that you're conscious of or aware of, then that is sensation. So sensations include things like sounds that you hear, right? That sound is not really a property of whatever is making that sound. That sound is a bunch of action potentials that are occurring in your brain. Okay, you don't feel a tack in your side at the place where the tack is sticking in your side. You feel it in your brain. All of your sensations are occurring in your brain. You don't see with your eyes, you see with your brain. Your eyes are involved. They're the receptors. But the perception of sight, the perception of hearing, and of taste, those all occur in the brain. So sensation is the conscious processing of sensory information. And stimuli that lead to sensations, in other words, stimuli that are usually conscious, those things are collected by or responded to by receptors that are parts of special sense organs. And I don't mean special is the actual name of them. I'm not just calling them special. There are special senses and there are general senses. Okay, I mentioned this before, that you were probably mistaught in grade school about what you were probably taught, that there were only 5 senses, first of all. There's more than that. And I'm not talking about ESP. special senses are the ones that involve highly localized receptors that are, meaning in one place, that are parts of highly complex sense organs. And there are four special sense organs, all located in the head, the tongue, the nose, the eyes, and the ears, like I said. There are five special senses, though, because the ears do double duty. They are the special sense organs for audition, which is hearing, and for balance, which some books call equilibrium, which I don't like that word. But when you see equilibrium with respect to sense, that's talking about balance. The general senses are all of the other senses. What makes them general, and why they're called that linguistically, is that they are not highly localized in their receptors. The receptors are spread out either on the surface of the body or within the depth of the body. They're not just located in the head. And so those general senses can be broken down into somatic senses, which are peripheral. They're superficial, at the skin surface, basically. And visceral senses, which are deeper. The receptors are located deeper in the body. You don't have nearly as many visceral receptors deep in your body as you do these superficial receptors, these somatic receptors in your skin. And that's simply because your skin is your interface between you and the rest of the world. So things that are happening outside of you come to be known by virtue of interfering with your surface somehow. That includes the special senses as well. I mean, light coming from the page of the book that you're reading is reflected off that page and hits your eyeball. That's at the surface as well. But all of these somatic senses that are part of the general senses occur at the skin surface. You don't have nearly as many things telling you about what's going on inside you, at least as far as your awareness of them is concerned. All right? In other words, you don't really feel your liver. Your liver doesn't itch. But there's a lot of stuff going on subconsciously as well, behind the scenes. For instance, proprioception. The word proprioception refers to the sensory information about the positioning of your various body parts. Your brain needs to know where your various limbs and other parts are in space at any given moment. Now, you can be made aware of that. For instance, if I think about it, I can feel my little toe. But I'm not usually thinking about it. My brain is always aware of where it is, though, because it's receiving information about muscle length and tension. How much your muscles are stretched or not stretched is continuously being sent to the brain. It wouldn't be adaptive for you to be made aware of every little bit of information that the brain is receiving, right? It would drive you insane. But it's impressive that the brain is keeping track of all that stuff behind the scenes. But also a lot of important things about processes. So blood pressure, for instance. You know, when I talk about set points are values that you want to keep these various variables at. But it makes no sense to have a set point unless you have some way to do something about it, right? Well, you can't know whether a variable is at the set point unless you can measure the variable. So there's a lot of sensory information sent to the brain about blood pressure, for instance, pH, body temperature. Those things are subconscious as well. You don't know what your blood pH is right now unless you measure it. All right, so there's a dichotomy there. I think I'll stop there then. I just wanted to start that.